Top Shelf, der Leadership-Podcast für Konsumgüter und Handel mit Dr. Marcel Hane und Florian Schmitz.
What a special day, the 10th episode of Top Shelf and our first episode in English. Marcel, who is our guest today?
We are very happy and very proud to welcome Alejandro Bethlen. Alejandro is the Executive Vice President for the International Business of Weight Watchers. And today with him in front of our microphone, we are meeting a truly international executive who has worked across continents and across segments. So very, very warm welcome, Alejandro. Happy that you're with us.
Thank you guys very much. Really cool to be here. And I'm excited that this is the first English version of the podcast that I get to help and participate on.
You are a special guest.
Thank you.
So Alejandro, for our listeners, maybe you can just give us a little introduction of who are you, who would you describe yourself as a professional, and also your journey so far?
Yeah, without a doubt. As stated, Alejandro, I am currently Executive Vice President for Weight Watchers. I've only been there for about 4 months. I'm based in Munich, but I manage all countries outside of the U.S., so it's 10 different countries outside of the U.S. that I manage. And I've grown up pretty much as an international executive as an adult and with my father as an international expat kid, as he was an international executive as well. So born in Argentina, have lived in six different countries. So Venezuela, Bolivia. Venezuela's on the news a lot, so a lot more people know about Venezuela, but I've lived there twice. The United States 4 times, Panama and Germany. This is my second time living in Germany. And as you mentioned, I think that most of my career post my MBA has been at CPG, so Procter & Gamble, where I was 7-8 years there. And then after that at Amazon. And I think Amazon opened up my career after that to go towards more tech and e-commerce companies where I've spent my time since being at Amazon. I think at Weight Watchers, it's health tech and health and wellness. And that's where I've been the last 4 years and really excited about what I'm doing there now.
If you look at your childhood and moving around, how did this shape you as a professional? So what did you take from this time?
Yeah, I think absolutely. It took me probably up until I was 20, 22 years old to start understanding some of the benefits. But I think that you get really good at ambiguous situations. You get really good at pattern recognition. You become very curious, right? You don't think things are stupid. You think they're interesting because every time you're moving, you're seeing different ways of people, cultures doing something. I had an executive that reported me in Japan that told me, you can tell you're international. And I asked him why. And he says, most people, when we tell them this is how we do this in Japan, they say that's stupid. And you always say that's interesting, right? And so I think it just gives you a curiosity and a general openness that is beneficial. And we hear this all the time, you know, when people experience different languages, different cultures, it opens their mind. When this is how you were raised and your whole life was based on that, it really does shape how you look at situations.
If we talk about Weight Watchers, your current position, and you said you just moved in, and Weight Watchers is on the news a lot at the moment because you're changing so much. Yeah. At the same time, if you say Weight Watchers, everybody knows the brand, connects something with it. Where do you stand at the moment as a company?
I think we're at an inflection point. I think that it's a brand that probably wasn't being managed and led as a brand as well as it could be. And if you look today, we're probably talking weight because of the GLP-1s more than anybody has in the last 20 or 30 years.
Can you quickly explain GLP-1? Because I'm not sure if everybody knows it.
Yes. So GLP-1, many people will have heard of it, Wegovy or Zepbound or Ozempic. They're medications that for the most part have been injectable up until now, but starting soon, there's also going to be pills that you'll be able to take. And what they do is that they, I won't go into all the details, but they help suppress appetite and helps suppress food noise, which creates a calorie deficit, which can lead to quite fast weight loss in 3-4 months. And I think that right now with this medications and a lot of new medications of this type, of this technology coming out, it's important that a company like Weight Watchers rejoins the conversation and help explain that one of the major foundational things that you need to do while you're doing, while you're taking these medications is the behavioral change component. And before the podcast, you know, all three of us were talking a lot about behavior change. It doesn't matter if it's with the medication, without the medication, a diet, a workout, unless you can establish healthy eating habits, healthy exercise habits, nothing's going to keep weight off forever unless you're able to also change your behavior. And I think that that's where Weight Watchers has excelled for 60 years. We launched in Germany, I believe it was in late 60s, early 70s.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, that was before my time, but
yes.
Just when I don't remember.
Yes, and so I think that most people you talk to have an aunt or a mother or a cousin or a sister, somebody that's done Weight Watchers. And I think if you talk to all of them, it has a lot of very positive equity. It has a lot of nostalgia. But now what we need to do is polish the brand and bring it to 2026 and incorporate what we offer with being able to support people that are on these medications and helping them understand what to expect, how to be able to adapt their lack of hunger, what they should be focusing on from food. And again, the behavior change that's important for them to undertake while they're on this medication.
If I think about the brand Weight Watchers, I would assume it's still counting points probably, but you said that you want to repolish the brand. Did you ever thought about just maybe finding a new brand name? Was this necessary? Or did you say that having this brand name, which has such a unique brand awareness, is a treasure you should keep?
Yeah, and so you guys have seen a lot of the commercials that have come out in the last month. So we're starting to really push the brand message out again after being quiet in Europe for quite a while. I think that what we designed as an executive team, what our chief experience officer, decided, is that we shouldn't run from the name, we should lean into the name. From a business perspective and my CPG perspective, I agree completely for two reasons. One, Weight Watchers awareness in Germany, in UK, in France is above 80%. For anybody that's worked in a small medium brand or anybody that's worked on an online brand, the most expensive thing in the world is building awareness, mm-hmm. right? And so when you have that type of awareness, in the US, it's mid to high 90s, right? When you have that type of awareness, you really have to think twice if you're going to change the brand name. The second thing that I think was super important is that as you look and talk to people about the brand, as you go to the workshops, nobody doubts Weight Watchers can work and has worked, right? I think that even people that are dietitians, clinicians, doctors are going to tell you that these are very effective programs. When you talk to people, I think that you get a sense that the brand was a little old, let's say, but the equity was quite strong. There was no negative associations. So for me in that situation, it would just be a little, it wouldn't be the most intelligent thing to do to change the brand name, right? And throw away the equity and the goodwill that you have with your members and the community as well.
From a personal point of view, what did you convince to make the move? Every move has its risk, yeah, every career choice. And especially when you have such a transformation journey ahead of you, yeah, you think twice. What is it that did the trick for you?
You know, I think that when I left Zooplus, I worked at Zooplus, which is an e-commerce retailer in the pet space. They're in 30 countries in Europe, but they're based in Munich. I left there in April, and I had been going to the gym for about a year, but wasn't able to. I think I was sleeping better. I was better from a stress perspective. We had talked about this before, like as an executive, you don't take care of yourself quite well. But I still wasn't able to lose the weight I wanted. And also learning how to eat differently wasn't a very easy thing. So I went through my own path, trying to understand what to eat, what not to eat, who to listen to. There's so many voices right now between podcast and YouTube of different people saying different things. And as I started to get deeper into this health space, I realized how confusing, how difficult it was, and how much you needed kind of a trusting guide, especially with the medications and GLP-1s coming out, a trusting guide. And what I notice is most of the market is focusing on one component, but nobody's focusing on the medical, the behavioral component at the same time. So when I was called to talk to the CEO of Weight Watchers, of course, this to me made all the sense in the world because I felt that they have all the pieces that they need to really make impact on people's lives by being able to combine the behavioral and the medical, right? And so, yeah, it was right place, right time, and right from a personal perspective on what I was going through.
Yeah.
And I think that the line that, to me, brings the Proctor and the Amazon and the Weight Watchers and Zooplus together, there's a line on consumer. Consumer insights, consumer understanding, consumer problem that you're trying to solve. And this one, to me, was something that I was passionate about.
So your experience built the right path to get there at the right time, as you said. And if you think about consumer, did the consumer change over time? Because if I think back on Weight Watchers, it was, or maybe it's still today, mainly female-oriented. But for example, I was on a conference yesterday, and the first thing that the guys talk about is their good behaviors for the beginning of the year, how much sport they do, how much they're counting calories and so on. And everybody was showing on the iPhone what they do currently. And said, okay,
maybe... That would have been a different conversation 10, 15 years ago.
Exactly. So is your target group changing?
That's an amazing question. Great question. Also great insights. Right now in Europe, we're 90 to 92% female. And I think we have the opportunity to much better target our product for males as well. And so I think that right now we need to continue to focus on improving the product, improving the brand, and this is what we're doing right now. But I think that, yes, in the future, one of the things that I'm super interested about is being able to create a product, which ends up being a space for men as well, right? I think that if you think about the things that men are going to talk about from behavior change and exercise are going to be different than females. And I think that they need a bit of a safe space as well to be able to share some of these questions, some of these emotions as well. So not yet, but yes, this is something that we know we need to do a better job of because there's not a holistic product for men, right? And if you look at YouTube or podcast, by far, it's tilted much more towards men. So the need is there, the demand is there. We need to make sure that we start looking at that in the future as well.
You mentioned your previous career stage at P&G, at Amazon, at Zooplus. If you look back, like in hindsight, what did those positions, those companies and cultures bring to your development? How did they shape you as an executive?
Yeah, and so let me tie that back to kind of the way I grew up, right? And so, like I told you, I've lived in six countries, and so I moved around quite a bit. And what you get really good at is not missing the past or dreaming about the future. You get good at just being happy where you are, in the country you are, in the city you are. And so I never regret having lived anywhere, and I never look forward to moving somewhere. I really try to focus on where I'm at. And I'm the same way with my career in the companies, right? Every company I've worked at has taught me something. Some have taught me things I wouldn't want to do, roles I wouldn't want to do, companies I wouldn't want to do, whatever it may be. But I've also learned, and I think sometimes knowing what you don't want to do is learning as well, right? People don't think about that. But I think that to me, going through roles or type of roles or type of companies that you didn't enjoy, I think is a bit of a learning that makes you a more intelligent executive in the future. And so I would say that to me, in every single company, I've learned something. And I always think of my career as, I'll call it muscles, right? When you go to the gym, you don't want to just do right leg for 5 years. That makes absolutely no sense. You have to do right leg, and then you have to do left leg, and then you have to do your arm and the other arm, et cetera. And I see a career as that, right? And so while I've been in consumer most of my career, they've been all different aspects of consumer, right? I've worked at laundry detergent on Tide and Ariel. I've worked in, which is super, super female. I've worked at Amazon in musical instruments, where it was much more male. I've worked in PCs, in computers, which was a bit more male as well. I've worked in Amazon Flex, which is the last mile delivery, which is operations. But always, for me, with the consumer aspect in mind of preparing to run a company, right? And so, yeah. And so to me, in each one, I learned, I think, a different foundational building block that got me to where I am.
And what did you take from P&G? What did you take from Amazon?
So P&G, to me, are probably some of the best people leader you'll ever meet. I think that you're trained how to think and how to lead. You're trained how to communicate effectively, how to write effectively. I think that something we don't spend enough time is the importance of written and verbal communication and leadership, and how being a very clear, and that means usually being a very simple communicator, is so important to ensure that any organization, any team knows what they're supposed to be doing, what the direction is. Procter is very good at that. I had a mentor one time at Procter that told me there's 12 reasons why we should do this, but I'm going to tell you three, right? And don't go into all the details and spend time saying, oh, no, no. What are the three reasons? How do you simplify the communication and get people on board? Procter is really good at that. Procter is really good at strategy, right? But when I was there, Procter, I think, was struggling with execution. They were too internally focused. They were too slow. Spending more time managing internal process than executing to the consumer. A Procter & Gamble CEO named A.G. Lafley says the only strategy the consumer sees is execution. And I think Procter was losing that a bit and was getting way too complex. Go to Amazon. In my view, Amazon doesn't train leaders on how to communicate, how to coach, and all that. And so in my view, and hopefully none of my Amazon friends get upset by this, you have a lot of leadership variability in motivational, inspirational type leadership, because they don't train for that. They train people that can execute and get things done. I've never seen a company, and I don't think there are going to be many companies that can execute as well as Amazon does. Right. And so how Amazon thinks about execution, how they think about metrics, what to measure, how to measure, why to measure, I think was an amazing experience. And so I would say that the two foundations for me were those two. And so I do think that motivating people, communicating, aligning people, pointing them in the right direction is super important. I also think executing is super important. And so to me, I'm somebody that believes in that balance and what I call a lot IQ and EQ, right? I think you need the empathy on how to lead teams and get the most of them. And I think you also need to know that what you want them to work on and how you're going to measure if they're working on the right things. So a good example, really quick, you see a lot of companies, they'll give somebody a goal of sales. Nobody can drive sales. Right? You can drive conversion, you can drive distribution, you can drive purchase intent, but you don't drive sales. Sales is an output. So to me, most companies sit there and tell people, go focus on this output. I'm not going to tell you how to get it done. There's 20 levers that you need to get it done, but I'm going to measure you on the output. It doesn't make sense. You should measure on the inputs that they have the ability to influence, that they can execute again, and measure those. And sales will be the output if you get all the inputs correct. And so this mentality of Amazon I have found super successful or super beneficial later in my career, ensuring that you get the right people on the bus, you point them in the right direction, and then you goal them on the right KPIs, and then you focus on the execution.
If you think about your time at Amazon, were you able to bring this P&G leadership style also to Amazon? Did Amazon learn something from that? And did this change over time?
Well, I don't know if Amazon learned something. Right? It's a huge company, right? It was a huge company. No, but I think that if you talked to most of the people that worked on my teams, I think that they would say that I was one of the people that took that more seriously, the motivational aspect of it. And I would think that they would say that I was one of the better leaders they worked with, right? And, you know, I do have, at different times when we started to measure, you know, the cultural surveys that companies always do, both at Amazon and at Zooplus when I was there, those measures would be amongst the highest amongst my peer set, because I do focus on that. And to me, you know, I think a lot of people say culture is important, but they don't measure it. And they don't drive ratings of executives by it. And why? Like, I think measuring sales, share, that's a lot easier to do, right? You have the data. Measuring culture and the positive impacts of culture it takes longer than 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. It takes several years. And so when you see higher churn, right, when you see lower satisfaction scores, how do you sit there and measure both those components, but also the positive components that those things bring? And so I don't think companies are good at that. I think it's a hard thing to measure. But I think that most executives would probably tell you that culture makes a massive impact on business results, right?
Yeah, it shapes the behavior. Yeah, it shapes the behavior, how you engage with your colleagues and with your clients, and how you engage with the market.
Yeah, and I may get this wrong. I can't remember if it was called Project Oxygen or not, what it was called. But Google, there was a chief people officer there at some point called Laszlo Bock, and he was head of people for Google, and he would try to find ways to measure what makes teams successful, right? And they measured a lot of things like tenure, years of experience, the degrees they had, the type of schools that they had, the seniority, the location, all these different types of things. And they would ask a bunch of questions of these different teams over time to try to understand what were the driving factors of success. And over and over and over again, number one or number two was also always something called psychological safety. And so you guys have worked for bosses that are micromanagers, and over time, you find it difficult to think. Like, you almost, or you tell them, hey, is this okay? Is this okay? You almost have, you're not thinking and you're not executing at speed. You've also worked for managers that were supporters and coaches and gave you space. And what was the throughput and the impact you were able to have in each scenario? It's a massive difference. And so to me, the psychological safety, allowing your team to feel that they have space to execute, that you're not going to judge them or fire them incorrectly for trying and being wrong. So one of the things I always tell my teams is my priorities are the right action, number one, number two, the wrong action, and number three, inaction. I'd rather you be wrong than not do anything. Right, and you really have to push that. You know, another one, and I'm sure if any of my old teams hear this, they're going to laugh, is I always say, ask for forgiveness, not permission. Right, and so in Zooplus, I had when I took over the team, it was very German culture where they were nervous of taking risk. German culture, but also a culture that was a little scared by the amount of changes as well. And so I really started pushing the, you know, ask for forgiveness, not permission. I set up an award called the Just Do It Award and bought a size, I think it was 20 Nike shoe. I bought a size 20 Nike shoe in green, like Zooplus, and would give it away once a month. And it was to drive this ability to feel comfortable taking risks. And it was hilarious because I sat down with HR after 6 months and there was two or three instances where you wanted to go to the person and go, no, but you shouldn't have done this. But the HR person was like, you can't say that because you're the ones that are telling them to do this. And like, you're absolutely right. I'm going to bite my tongue and let it go. And so, but again, psychological safety. And so I think that, this is hugely important to team effectiveness and impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in the Weight Watchers, you're now in 4 months in the role massive changes, turning more or less everything around. How do you create this? What are you doing now to create the sense of psychological safety while at the same time you need to have the focus on execution?
Yeah, I mean, you know, another concept I overuse is crawl, walk, run, right? I think that, you know, I don't think you can change everything overnight. I think that you need to really focus on getting momentum, getting the small wins. And so to me, the first thing I do with all people that are in my team or in my orbit is make sure that I'm able to align them on the vision or where I'm trying to go, what I'm trying to do, and why I'm trying to do it. Make them feel comfortable with that. You know, one of the things my theories of life is nobody likes being told what to do, right? Smart people don't like being told what to do. Smart people want to be part of the change. They want to understand the why. They want you to hear their opinion and be part of the change. And so to me, the first part is that, is going, here's the current business situation. We agree on this. If we continue to do this, we're not going to fix the company. We agree on this. What is the core of the company we need to keep? What are the things we need to change? And once you start aligning on that, start measuring and talking and making decisions through that filter that you've aligned on. I think that that's been pretty much the first stage. And second, it was a business where international didn't have a voice. And a lot of the central resources sat in New York. And so then reestablishing that voice, getting the international team to feel confident that we are going to be listened to, that we are going to have an input, and then representing that input in the U.S. to be able to impact or to help steer some of the decisions for global, right? And so I think that component so far is been successful, and this is the journey we're on now.
How do you decide, like, you're responsible for 10 different markets with 10 different cultures, and every culture might connect something differently to Weight Watchers. So how do you take the decision to say, this is something we do centralize and this is something we do differently locally?
Yeah, and so, look, this, funny enough, it's not different at almost any company I've seen, that the central team thinks that one way should work for every country. And every country says, no, I have these four regions or these provinces that are different and everybody needs something different. We were talking about this just before, right, with the person that was doing the podcast before. And so I think that there's always a happy median. And my goal is to have 70%, again, I'm using a number just to explain the direction, 70% of a base platform product that you would scale globally in a business where we're trying to scale the app, the digital components, you know, 70% should be a standardized global platform. And then having an innovation pipeline that looks at that 30% customization, where's the biggest impact of that 30% customization, be it in the workshop programs, the app, the marketing, whatever it may be. But I think that you do need some type of scale to be able to ensure that at least 60, 70, 80% of the product is the same.
Right? In the beginning, you said something, you mentioned a name, the Chief Experience Officer.
Yes.
Probably that's at least new to me. I never heard that before. Is this part, it's a different name for the CEO, or is this a completely different function? And this is, does this have something to do with the vision of Weight Watchers? So tell us something about the Chief Experience Officer.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a role, and it's not the CEO role. The person's name is Julie Rice. And I think the Chief Experience Officer is, how do you recreate the experience consumers have in a physical workshop, right? And again, I don't want to oversell it, but it's the magic that happens there, the psychology that happens there. This is the glue that's kept us alive as a company for 60 plus years. How do you recreate that?
I'm not sure if everybody connects Weight Watchers with the meetings you explained to us. Huh?
Yes, and so I would say the most Weight Watchers has different components. You know, a lot of people will know it for the points, which mm-hmm. is a simplified, let's call it, way to track what you're eating and the calories and what you're eating. It obviously, in the past, a lot of people associate it with meals. There was licensing that we would do with the types of foods that we know are better for you from a calorie perspective. But I would say that the core foundational product for the behavioral program is the workshops. And these are workshops that you can sign up to and go with a coach where you talk about different trips on different tricks on how to change your behavior, how to ensure that you're moving more throughout the day, creating exercise habits that will help you maintain healthier weights for a longer time. And so it's really training you about what to eat, how to eat, things to do from an exercise. Also giving you a lot of psychological support, right? That this isn't, you're not training for the Olympics. It's not hardcore that you have to do for 6 months. No, it's a life journey. And how do you change your behaviors to improve little by little over time? Right, and it's been super effective. Anybody that goes to one of the workshops will see one, two, three people that have been using it on and off for many, many years that have lost 20, 30, 40 kilos, right? And so you go there and you understand the magic of community, the magic of community support, and why it's so impactful in helping change behaviors. And so her job is to find that magic and how do we improve the offline experience, right? I think that we have to modernize it. But just as importantly, how do you get that magic, that psychology to work online, right? And of course, there's companies that have been able to do that. We were talking earlier, Peloton, right? You know, Peloton, to me, one of the biggest unlocks is when they went from seeing themselves as a spinning class company or an exercise health company to see themselves as an entertainment company. And the way people talk about Peloton, the way people feel about Peloton, it's not normal when you think about it as a spinning class. Why? Because it's not a spinning class. It's much more than a spinning class.
You stop talking about the sport, but you start talking about the experience that is connected to it.
Exactly. And so imagine if somebody goes to the gym, they're never going to tell you about the experience. Well, but at Peloton, people tell you about the experience. Well, and this, the chief experience officer, her role is to figure out how do we bring that emotion, how do we bring that class, not only to improve the offline, but also to bottle the magic online as well.
So you say basically that there are a few components that drive the success. It's first the trigger, then it's the community that you do, and the experience that you have with it. If you, for example, think, I mean, that's for consumers, but if you think about people working in your company, and you explained this with Zooplus and the shoes and the awards that you gave out before, basically you also, at this point of time, you already created the community of your people, of your team, that you put this trigger, you created an experience that drove a different result. So basically that's more or less the same. So can you convert the Weight Watchers success factors also to leadership, to running teams?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, I've never thought about it in that way. But at the end of the day is, the trigger, I have something's broken, I have an idea. I go and I fix it, and my manager gets mad and yells at me that it wasn't my job. That's going to lead you to learn, okay, when I have this idea and I do this action, I get in trouble, I'm not going to do it. So how do you rewire that? Yeah, it's the same formula that we've been talking about. Is when they do the action, change the reward at the end, right? And I do think, look, I'll often say things that I mess up. Why? And try to be public and vocal about it. Why? Well, because it gives others the ability to understand, like, ooh, okay, it's okay to say that. We don't have to hide from that, right? And so, yeah, absolutely. I think that those rewards I was doing is exactly that, is that you get this action, you know, regardless of the output that comes, you know, there's going to be benefit culturally and to the impact of the company over time. Look, if you look at Amazon, there's many, many, many more things that we failed at when I was at Amazon than we succeeded at. Mm-hmm. But the ones you succeeded at were huge, right? The Fire Phone didn't work, right? Again, my Amazonian friends won't love this. I don't think Alexa's working really well, right? Like, hopefully the new version will improve. They did an agency to book airlines, flights digitally, didn't work. They launched an eBay compete type marketplace, didn't work. They launched a Groupon type thing, didn't work. Prime Now didn't work. I mean, there's a lot of things they failed at, right? But what I loved is that their philosophy is, if I don't figure it out, somebody else will, right? And they're willing to fail in order to find the home runs that do work, right? And so I think that that mentality is super, super important. And second, and you and I had talked about this earlier, is how you view yourself as a company is so important. So I always tell friends this, like, to make this point. You know, I'll say, you know, would you buy a Dell telephone? And people look at me and go, a what? Would you buy a Dell telephone? Why would I buy a Dell telephone? And you're like, well, why wouldn't you? And they're like, well, because it's a computer manufacturer. And I'm like, well, but what was Apple? Apple was a computer manufacturer. And it always trips them up. And the reality is Apple never said we're a computer manufacturer. Apple never positioned themselves. Apple positioned themselves as beauty, simplicity, making complex things easier for the consumer. People would buy an Apple car.
Also because of the experience
exactly,
that we are getting.
Exactly. Yeah? People would buy an Apple car. They'd buy an Apple TV. Like, but nobody... By the way, Dell launched something called Zoom or something like that, which was like an iPod. And if I'm not mistaken, you guys can look it up. I think it launched at the same time or before. Remember, like, I always find it fascinating. Apple's usually, besides the iPad, doesn't lead the innovation. They follow, but do it
and do
10
it really
times
well.
Better.
Yeah. Yeah.
They beautify the innovation.
Exactly. And so to me, like, I think it's always important. Amazon never saw themselves as a retailer. What Amazon became, Walmart could have become. Target could have become. A lot of companies could have become. And another one that I'm passionate, like, look at eBay. eBay was about, they saw themselves as a transactional marketplace. They focus on the efficiency, brought a bunch of Bain consultants in all the time. And look what eBay is now. And now all of a sudden, it's super hot, Real, Vestiaire Collective and all that. You know, that could have been eBay. They just didn't see themselves as this sharing economy. eBay could have been Airbnb.
You're right. And how would you describe then the self-awareness or the picture of Weight Watchers? Would you describe yourself maybe as a healthcare company? Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's a health and wellness company. And I think that as we reposition the brand, as we start I really do think we have all the puzzle pieces we need to make this successful. As we start putting this together, I do think that it lends itself to many, many other. So if, again, going back to Peloton, those communities have ended up creating book clubs. Those communities have gone offline, not just online. They've been super powerful. So yeah, absolutely. And I think this health and wellness has the legs to be able to do that as well, right? To be able to create local communities that sit there and feed on each other from a health and wellness perspective with the consumers. And so from a product perspective as well, I think there's a lot of opening. As well.
You touched upon two principles that we met here at Top Shelf when we ask a question, okay, what is it that makes you successful? And then it's about changing the perception. And then in traditional FMCG, the move often enough was from I provide products to I provide solutions for my client. And the other thing is about, like, you need to have many things in your innovation pipelines. You need to try out a lot of stuff, but then you need to focus on the ones that really make you successful. And you need to, that's also connected to the ability to let things go when they don't work. just make them disappear from the market again.
Mm-hmm. So, but that was the question, was how do you do that?
No, it was something that we met over the past episodes and conversations a lot.
I think that always requires what I call healthy friction, right? And healthy friction is where you're positioning teams that you don't have to agree. It's okay that we have different points of views to really talk about something, but it's always difficult because I think that, look, one of the problems big brands have is that any small thing, if you're a billion on Tide. Tide, at the time I was there, Tide is like Ariel for North America. It's a laundry detergent. It was 2.53 billion US dollars in sales. And this product I launched that I was passionate about, it's called a washing machine cleaner. It's to clean the insides of the washing machines. And nobody cared. Nobody wanted to focus on it and all that, right? But the margin was amazing. I knew it was going to grow. I knew it had much more a margin for the retailers and for us. And so, I think that sometimes it's hard to get those small products to be part of what you're trying to do, even though they're growing well. So companies like Procter & Gamble sometimes have smaller with some of the more adjacent products. And so it's important to keep those in mind and have champions inside that are pushing them and looking after them. But at the same time, like you said, if something's a failure, and it goes back to what I told you, that making it okay to fail and not get in trouble that you tried is super important. And I don't think a lot of companies are good at that. And I actually, unfortunately, I don't think Procter is good at that. I don't think CPG companies are good at that. You know, CPG companies, with the amount of testing they tend to do before a product launches, they're trying to minimize failure at all cost, and they're trading speed to risk mitigate it.
And then failure becomes even more expensive.
More expensive, and then people get fired and stuff like that, right? So,
if we look at yourself and what's driving you, what is it that gives you energy in your day-to-day life?
I would say when you have a belief on the way something should be or the way something could be and why it could be such a big idea, why it could be so big, and I think that going through what I'm going through right now is a perfect example, is if you look at where the market is going, if you look at the amount that health and weight is being talked about today versus 10 years ago, it's really changing. If you look at, you guys mentioned about the males are talking more about their body, their health, than probably any time in the last 100 years, right? And about how they look and how they dress and taking pride in that much more than ever before. And so to me, the way I look at my current situation is like, I look and I see all the pieces and I'm like, oh my God, we have all the pieces. All I need to do is help the teams put them together so we can get where we want to go. And that to me is super exciting and invigorating, right?
And if you think exactly the opposite, what takes your energy?
I'm very, very, very bad at bureaucracy.
Is like administration or
slowness, more analysis. No, we need to talk to this person and do this and do that. No, we need to wait. No, like anything that's internal that's keeping you from execution. I don't do well in those situations. And I would say that...
Was this differently at P&G? Does this drive to execution come with Amazon?
At P&G, I was the same. Okay. At P&G, I was the same. Like, I think that if you talk to people that work with me in North America, I was probably the loudest complaining about the bureaucracy and the process and all that and just trying to break it and go around it. And, it just drove me crazy. Just to give you an example, to change the label of the laundry detergent, it was a 12 to 18 month project. And to me, that was just mind-boggling. Like I would angst and complain and meet with people and know. And so I've always been like that. Now, What I would tell you, if this helps anybody, 50-60% of it is okay, that's good. 40%, I've probably broken relationships and caused more pain than I should have on teams by being like that. And so is it important to be like that? I think so, but you need to make sure you're balancing it. And I think I've gotten better at it, but I still struggle with it sometimes. I just don't like slowness with obvious things that you need to do. So.
Your former peers, they can leave feedback in the comment section.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And maybe P&G at one point will get you in as a consultant with all your Amazon and co experience.
Well,
now.
No, the issue with P&G, and it's a tough one, they don't hire people from outside the company. They only hire MBA or university graduates, and then it's only promotion from within. Right. And so,
which can be a strong asset.
It's so intertwined with the Procter culture that it would be very difficult to change that. And I would agree. I think there was a CEO that came in, David Taylor. He came in at a difficult time and they were pushing him to change that, to bring in new skill sets. But, you know, he resisted, and I think resisted correctly. Like, I think it's a very difficult thing. Procter culture is so strong. But I do think that, and maybe they do, they should hire one, two in different areas to drive the change and the fire and stuff like that. Especially on new skills, where if you've always been in the company, you're not going to be as forward-facing in some of the new skills in digital that is if you were to hire experts from outside. And maybe they do that, so I'm not sure.
They can leave a comment as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we could talk for hours and hours, Alejandro, but time is already running up. So if we maybe have a closing word, and if our listeners take one idea away from this conversation and from you being here, what could this be or what should this be?
Oof, really good one. I think that, look, I would say two things. Number one is a mentor one time told me that if you want to get promoted fast, stay in the same role, in the same brand, in the same company for a long time. You'll become an expert much faster than anybody else. Everybody will always come to you, and you'll get promoted fast because of that. But when you get to a senior level position, it slows you down because people don't think you have the range needed. You don't have the experiences to be able to be at a senior level. Now, if you want to then optimize for more senior levels, you have to take different positions. Taking different positions, different brands, potentially different companies, slows you down because you're not that expert and you're going across people that have been doing the same thing longer. So it makes the promotions a little less speedy. But as you get to a senior position, they look and they say, okay, wow, this person has experience in this and this and this. And it makes you a much better senior executive candidate. And so to me is have patience, think of what you're trying to do, what you're trying to achieve, and where you're trying to go to, and consider those things, right? That it's not just about speed in the early and mid parts of your career, it's over the long term. And if you do want to get into the long term, ensure that within the same company or within the different companies, you're building things that make you a more holistic leader with different experiences. Right. And so I think that would be one of my key things.
Traditionally, we ask one last question. Do you have a recommendation for us who we should invite as a guest and why?
Oh, wow. You know, I think that an interesting one could be the CEO of Amazon Germany. Right. I don't know if you guys have met him, Rocco. He's a long, long time Amazonian. He's worked in Amazon in Germany, but was also the country manager of Amazon. And kind of digging into some of the Amazon ways of working, like the rituals that they do, why they do it, their thinking, right? I think that a lot of people ask me, like, oh, Amazon's so innovative. I don't think Amazon's innovative. Like, the things that they've done haven't been massive changes. but they can execute really, really, really well. And so talking about things like that. On the same token, and again, anybody that from Google, I apologize. Google, I think, is super innovative, right? They remember they had the contacts for diabetes. They did, I think that they were doing at one point, satellites for wireless.
And you always read something amazing that they are cooking up.
Yes, but I don't think they're good at executing. Mm-hmm. And so after 30 years, we still know Google for AdWords and search. And so, you know, I think that they've had difficulty harnessing some of these ideas into actual execution. Or Amazon, to me, even after I'm no longer there, is amazing. And so I think digging into that on why is Amazon so good at that? What do they do? How do they do it? I think is super interesting.
That could be a good conversation to have.
Yeah? Absolutely.
We will reach out. Thank you for being here, Alejandro. Thank you for taking the time. It was a pleasure to host you.
Thank you, guys. A lot of fun.
And a great experience. Thank you very
much. Thank you.